Hi everyone. The next talk that we're going to hear now is from Russell Cooper, who will be talking about Knut, the world's first working refreshable multi-line braille display. Thanks. Enjoy.
For the last 4.5 years, I've been working with a small team out of the back of Bristol Hackspace, which we're using as an open workshop. The main reason we work out of the Hackspace is to keep costs low, because it's a not-for-profit project and running on a minimal budget. The goal of the project is to make a multi-line refreshable braille display, and also to make it affordable. The current braille displays are very expensive, many thousands of pounds, and you only get one line. And the goal of this project is to make it for about £440 per unit, and that will be a full page rather than a single line. And the reason we're doing this is because currently there is no multi-line display available on the commercial market at all anywhere that we know of. There are some that are two lines. There's one that is, I think, four lines, but I think it was from a limited supply. And the lines were very short, so you couldn't get anywhere near a full sentence on it. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the single lines cost many thousands of pounds. As I'm an engineer on the team, I'm going to play a short video that we made a short while ago that is from Ed, who runs the project, and it will then have some Braillists who are actually using the machines, and you can hear their comments about the interaction and the benefit that these machines will make in their lives. And then after that, I'm going to move on to some technical details. And I've forgotten to ask, does everyone know what Braille is? Yeah. Is there anyone who doesn't know? All right, cool. That's. There we go.
Hello, I'm Ed Rogers, I'm the director of Bristol Braille Technology, and we are working on the Knut. The Knut is a radical new Braille e-reading device. It's like a Kindle for blind people. It makes digital Braille far more affordable than anything that currently exists on the market by having multi-line Braille, which means that you can see a whole page of Braille, and it will cost hundreds of pounds rather than thousands of pounds, which the existing models currently cost. Now, we want to take the prototypes that we've already made over the last couple of years. We're on the Mark 9 now. We want to take this prototype and we want to make a batch of them and trial them in schools around the UK, in Ireland, maybe in America. And we want to get the feedback from these schools about how to make the Knut into the perfect device for learning Braille and for literacy in general. We want the Knut to be a tool which can help reverse the decline in Braille usage and therefore increase literacy around the world. So we've been working with the Braillists. The Braillists is a community organisation established in 2014, designed to give a voice to blind people so that they can be involved in the creation of their own technology, especially around digital Braille.
Having an affordable multi-line Braille display would be transformative, I think, for Braille. Well, multi-line Braille would certainly make studying science and technology subjects more feasible, I think, for blind students. Take computer programming, for example, being able to review code across multiple lines of Braille. I think that would be a very powerful use case for multi-line Braille.
Great for children in school, you know, they could do maths on it, and well, you know, they could get hold of material, you know, be loaded onto it electronically so that it would be readily available in Braille.
It's very disempowering to be in a room and to be told, well, all the information you want is on the screen. But that doesn't help a blind person to feel that they're part of the meeting or part of the experience.
I use Braille every day of my life. Well, it would, hopefully it would mean that I'd have access to more books. And I can think of practical uses for it, like, for instance, I read in church once a month. And my Braille missal at the moment is 15 volumes. And searching for things in it is a nightmare. So, you know, it'd be much quicker if I could load the missal onto something like Canute. Same with recipes, I could take it to the kitchen and look up things instead of having to traipse up and downstairs to my computer to get the Braille stuff I want.
Well, for the last 2 years, the developers of Canute, Bristol Braille Technology, have worked closely with the Braillists, who are a community of, I think, around about 200 Braille enthusiasts. Some of us are Braille readers, some of us teach Braille, some of us are parents of children who read Braille. So Bristol Braille Technology have paid very close attention to the needs and the views of that community in the development of Canute.
I think very early on in the development of the Canute, blind people were involved. I certainly remember Ed contacting me and saying he needed to involve visually impaired people in testing and giving feedback, and generally being involved at every stage of the development.
We told them what we wanted in terms of the number of lines, the length of the characters, and they've gone away and tried to build this, you know, and this, and it's very gratifying to see that, you know, what's taken place, you know, what's actually come about.
For me, it's a great encouragement, and I think I feel it's really valuable. That I feel like I have a sense of ownership of this project, and a commitment to see it through to success.
I certainly feel glad that I've been a part of it. You know, I've been able to show off to some of my friends who don't live in Bristol, who, you know, have said, oh, I wish I was a part of that. I'd like to be a part of that, you know. It would be a good thing for me as well, you know.
So that's, it was a bit longer than I remembered, but that's why we're doing the project. And to summarise the goal, it's to increase literacy amongst blind people, because there's an overall decline in the use of Braille, which sort of cuts off access to books and other things. And we were also hoping that through involving them with the development of it, we could help bring more of the blind community into the hackspaces. And as a point of interest, one of the other goals is when the project is at a more finalised stage, is to release the knowledge in a CERN-based open source hardware licence. So moving on to some more technical things. The Braille is on a 2.5mm dot pitch. And then there are six pins, or six bumps, per cell. There's another grade of Braille that has eight pins, but we're working on six because it's mechanically easier to deal with. The pages we're working on is an American standard of 40 cells per line, and then or 40 characters per line, they're often referred to in Braille as cells, and then 13 lines per page. And the interesting thing there is you have 3,840 individual dots to address and control for each page refresh. So the equivalent of turning over the page in your reading book or diary would involve the control of 3,840 dots. And the thing that crosses everybody's mind, especially if they have some electrical or technological background, is it can be done with magnets or solenoids, and I'm sure that any one of you in there, in the audience, would be thinking much the same. But however, magnets just don't work. Because by the time you've built your electromagnet down to a 2.5 millimeter pitch, so as they're sitting in rows 2.5 millimeters apart, you'll get magnetic crosstalk. The core of the solenoid, being the bit that is actuated by the magnetic force, becomes so thin that the resultant force on it is nowhere near enough to take the force of somebody's fingertips going over the top. So really, the idea of using solenoids, even though it's the most obvious, is difficult. The other thing is cost, and things cost, and lots of things cost. So if you use an individual actuator per dot, not only is there a lot of them, but however inexpensive they are, having almost 4,000 of them is going to be prohibitively expensive to get something into the front room of your average guy who either needs it or who is interested in learning the medium of Braille. So our project has gone down the path of saying, well, can't we be more efficient with the use of actuators? And can't we address more than one dot or one bump with one actuator? And we've come down to a what we think is a minimum, which is using a matrix of actuators, one up the side of the machine and one across the top, to make a matrix of 16 row actuators and 40 column actuators, making a grand total of 56 actuators that would control individually the 384 bumps that would make a page of Braille. And we've done that by implementing and developing a cunning arrangement of gears and levers, and to coin a phrase that we often band round, is it's using the sort of tried and tested Victorian horology clockwork mechanisms with the modern control of microprocessors. And so far we've had promising success with it. The other task is to make the machine repeatable. One of the ideologies of the whole project was to not only open up literacy, Braille, to electronic devices in the developed world, but also make it available for people in the developing world, where I believe there's a higher instance of visual impairment. And for this, we'd have to be able to make each machine with accessible tooling, such as laser cutters, which we now find in every hackspace, CNC mills, which are almost an everyday thing, and 3D printing. But through our path of producing the machine and the prototypes, we discovered various materials limitations, such as nothing is flat, which might sound obvious, and it might not if you've never needed anything to be flat. We've come across problems of laser cutters distorting thin material. If you have a very thin sheet and you put lots of holes in it, it then warps in the middle because it's distorted, been melted on the edges. You can make very very complicated acrylic shapes. You can see some in some photographs in a moment. However, acrylic is fragile and it snaps. And if you get the wrong kind of solvent on it, it self-destructs in front of you. The other obvious material is acetyl. It's a kind of a wonder milling machine, millable material. However, acetyl bends. It is a soft material. So if you make a precise machine out of acetyl, it will no longer be precise in a day or two because you put it down irregularly and it slowly crept and distorted out of shape. The other engineering problems we've had are problems of miniaturization, in that we'll test an idea at 5 times scale, so you can pick it up and handle it. But then when you miniaturize it, it gets smaller, yet the accuracy of your machine stays the same. So the actual tolerance and scale are related. So as it gets smaller, the inaccuracy in, for instance, your laser cutter becomes more and more significant, and we've come across various problems with that as well. The other approach we've made is whenever we've tested a new idea, we've tested it on one braille cell with 6 pins. So you've got a lot of support around a very small area. But then when you increase that area to 40 cells, which is about a foot, 30 millimeters, then all of a sudden the force of resting a finger on the middle of a bar that's only 3 millimeters thick, for instance, is significant. And not only does it distort under the pressure of reading, but then any machine moving on this support rail underneath is applying force along the whole length, and then it bends. And we've ended up having to use, in the prototypes, ground carbide rods, which are prohibitively expensive for the final machine. And that presents another engineering problem we're going to have to get over before we can go into mass production. And the phrase at the bottom, we've not been able to run tests of miniaturization as we don't have the resources, is a combined problem of working on limited budget with the turnaround cost of having a lot of things rapidly prototyped, especially now as the machine has become so sensitive to tolerance that we've had to have parts for it made on some of the top 3D printers in the country, and we just don't have the resources to say we'll have one of those, then we'll have one slightly differently, and then one slightly differently again. We have to make an entire machine and almost guess that our intuitive calculations on why it went wrong the previous time were right. So to highlight some of the prototypes we've been through, this is one of the earlier ones. Some of you might recognize the simple stepper motors on the end as commonly available hacker type eBay purchase, sort of Chinese motors. And then the whole machine at that time was made out of acrylic, which was fairly good. It did the job. But if it suffered any kind of shock or blow, it would break. And also, as we strive to get the machine more repeatable and more accurate, we noticed that the laser cut edges were nowhere near as accurate as you would think. And that was a bit of an eye-opener to us all, because we'd all made many things on laser cutters. Personal things, projects, laser cut stuff's in our everyday life. But then when you start actually measuring it, the machines almost give you a different cut every day you go to them, despite nobody using it in between. So it's things like that. So we'd make one prototype and we'd make a duplicate, and they'd behave differently because they'd be cut out slightly differently. This particular machine uses brass pins and solenoids. So the rows up and up the side were controlled by stepper motors, and then the columns, for want of a better word, were controlled by solenoid actuation. This wasn't anywhere near our the figures I mentioned earlier for a number of actuators, but it was quite low. This is another prototype we made, much bigger stepper motors, more like the ones you'd find on RepRap 3D printers, only these are slightly bigger. The other problem that this brought with the laser cutter acrylic was stepper motors move in steps, which is an audible sound. Then when you have a bunch of them in a machine, that's sides are made from loosely clipped together or tightly clipped together acrylic sheet, you have a sounding board like a musical instrument, and the thing would sit there and buzz and click and whir like some sort of late 80s sort of rave booming box. It was quite comical, but nothing you could actually ever give out to anyone and say, here, this is a Braille machine, because it would disrupt anyone else in the room that might be with you. One of the materials we moved on to was acetyl, because it didn't break. We were having breaking problems with some of the smaller parts, as they were just not durable. So we used laser cut acetyl. And this was fantastic. However, it was apart from being slightly more expensive, it was bendy. And again, it was laser cut. And the problem, as I mentioned before, with laser cut is it's not as accurate as you would think. And this is compounded by the fact that the Delrin or the acetyl melts as it's cut. So when you're making gears out of acetyl and interacting parts, is there's a greater level of unknown than you would like. I put this on because I found it quite a comical photo. We had to demonstrate this to some sort of partners or colleagues in America, and on basically the evening before of the flight, we were working with this prototype, and someone said, how are you going to carry it through customs, because you can't possibly put this on the whole of the plane. A briefcase appeared out of nowhere, and it was put in there like some child's comedy spy film briefcase. And we thought, what with the current state of things, that this would, because this only flew earlier in the year, this one, we thought it would produce all manner of security problems, taking it to a demo, which was very important, because that's the sort of forum and the place where we can demonstrate our research and prototypes in order to gain more funding and credibility amongst the communities we're trying to support. And really, it produced no trouble at all in airport security and getting it on an airplane, which is a surprise for us. So we're not quite sure what they're looking for there. This is the first working prototype. We were able to give this to people, and they had it in their homes for a few days, one guy a few weeks. And this has a Raspberry Pi in it that has a select number of books that we've converted the format on. And there's various, you see the buttons up and down each side, the black buttons for selecting menu options. However, I say unforeseen problems is we developed this one for several months, put it in the box, tested it, gave it to people, tested it. It was fine because everyone treated it like it was worth a fortune, like it was some precious artifact. And then one day someone was walking with it and did not much more than a comedy trip, taking it to someone for a demo, and the pins bounced higher than they'd bounced before and rested on another internal part of the mechanism and stayed there. On that occasion, we had to completely dismantle the machine, reset the pins, put them in with tweezers, because I think there's about 500 on this particular machine. And once they're back in, assemble it, take it out to the next demo. And on the second time it did it, we decided that it wasn't worth the 3 days of disassembly and reassembly. So we had to move on to the next prototype and completely eradicate that as a possible failure. For each idea we have, we've had to test it. Unfortunately, this isn't as clear as it was, but we're testing a rackened motor mechanism. So instead of solenoids, moving to more controllable motors. And often when we produce things like this, is we set them going, we put some kind of feedback on them, whether it be optical with a Raspberry Pi camera or merely contact switches, and leave them running for several days to prove to ourselves that the idea is going to be successful. And again, this is one of many prototypes and mock-ups that we've had to make. The other way of testing ideas, again, this is looking at a rack and pinion idea, is you make something larger. This looks like it's about 5 scale. And even with the best CAD images, there is nothing like making something and having it in your hands and poking it, prodding it, flexing it, and just seeing how it works when it moves and interacts with the rest of the mechanism. These also proved invaluable because we demonstrate every couple of months to various Braillist groups that we've set up around the country. And it's almost empowering to give something like this out to a Braille audience and say, this is what we're talking about, this is what's on the screen. And you can feel the gear and the pinion interact. And with not so much this one, but with other ones, this is how we make the dots rise up and down. Because without that, it's very difficult to explain to a visually impaired person what exactly it is you're talking about. And this is another idea of gears and interaction. And assembly is a separate problem. It's all very well designing these mechanisms, but the assembly of them is crucial. And I've put this one up because it's made of many laminates. The whole machine was made, I think there were 4 or was it 5 acetyl laminate sheets for each Braille cell, and then we wanted 40 of these in a row. And these were held in alignment with, we actually used the bicycle spoke, it was the right diameter, and they're hardened material, with bicycle spokes threaded through long ways. So if you needed to maintain or inspect a portion in the middle of the machine, you had to slide these spokes out, and then the machine promptly fell apart under you like some sort of crazy origami failure. And again, you don't think about these things until you've built a machine, and it's ready to assemble, and then you want to take it apart again, and you know it's unforeseen problems. I've mentioned several times the problems we've had with laser cutting. The fact is, some of the things we do are not suited for CNC milling. So more recently, about springtime this year, we started moving to 3D printed parts, and it's beyond the scope of any DIY 3D printer because of the tolerance and the accuracy we need. We've ended up having the center of the machine now all 3D printed. Which is a step away from having it made in the back of a hack space in a developing country, but our development and our learning proved that was an unachievable target. And these particular 3D parts are produced on a machine that can, at its highest resolution, give 16 micron layers, and then an overall accuracy across the full area it works on of something like 0.3 millimeters, which is about within what we can accept. So the project has gone from, you know, laser cut parts through its range of materials and then onto 3D parts. Unfortunately, I was going to bring a demo in. I was going to bring what we call a POC, a proof of concept machine, which is a piece of hardboard with circuit boards screwed onto it and maybe 3 or 4 cells in the middle working. But we posted that to a researcher in America last week. And the actual demo is with some Braillists. I believe it's in Worcester, one of the schools in Worcester at the moment. So I couldn't bring that in. And I didn't think it valid to bring in just a few bits. So unfortunately, I have no physical demo for that. So the next stage after using 3D printed parts is then to have them injection molded, which is the only way you can produce things of this accuracy with any kind of repeatability and cost advantage, which is something we hope to move into next year. So that's about as far as I got with with what I was going to talk about. So if anyone wants to ask any specific questions. Oh, yes. Ah, oh, right, your microphone, yeah. Cheers.
What sort of production volumes are needed? How many do you expect to make?
At the moment, we're making 6 working prototypes, which will be the first ones that will go out to people on a sort of beta test. And we've got some of the Braille groups will share one. We've got schools and colleges, and I believe there's at least one going to American colleagues. But the overall goal. Which Ed, in the short video I showed you at the beginning, is thousands. He wants it to be mass-produced. And we've got the support of the RNIB in this country. We've got I think personal friends is the wrong way of putting it, but we're now on talking terms with their research guys. They're interested in the project, and he has a similar interest from the equivalent of the RNIB in America. So it is, when it hits production, hopefully it will be mass produced. So I hope that answers your question.
Two questions and then something to mention. So questions, what is your target price for this? And is the machine going to also have a Braille keyboard that is the typical 10?
The 6.
The
target price is very difficult to predict, but we're aiming for the target price to be about £440, so around the £500 mark, and that was for a full page, which is why. Did you miss the beginning?
No, I saw the.
All right, sorry.
16 line by 40.
Yeah, 69 by 49, which is one of the major cost. Benefits is a reduced number of actuators, yet more moving parts. So you know the idea is to open up literacy or Braille to people who are just interested, as well as people who would depend on it. Talking about the keyboard, we plan on having remote links or radio links, whether it be Wi-Fi, Bluetooth network, or whatever, to other devices. So as for instance, you could have your text go straight to it. Which means it looks quite bulky at the moment, but hopefully it'll be laptop size. So as you can read your text, for instance, on a bus without the guy next to you having to listen in on every occasion, if it's through a text-to-speech type thing. That's.
Have you compared to existing refresher Brailles where they have like a 1 or 2 line display and a 9 key keyboard?
Keyboard.
It's not a full keyboard, it's the Braille.
Yeah, it's the Braille keyboard. It's based on the Perkins machine, yeah. It is something we talk about, but we're so concentrating on making the display that almost a row of buttons on the front is a technical triviality. It might be a huge, huge feature and very useful, but from a development point of view, it's something we can't focus on because we have had a fair amount of money, but it's still limited for the development. And once it's on the machine, it's difficult to remove. Sort of feature theory. Once a feature's there, it's difficult to take away. And it's very easy to add it afterwards and go, version 2's got a keyboard. We'd have to, do that. So I hope that.
Fair enough. Also, just separately, one thing to mention is I'm running crash courses in blind navigation, hopefully not too crash, ad hoc, so I actually do use a cane. So if you would like to know how to do so, just come find me, it's on the schedule.
Sure. Mm. 2 questions, how much harder would it be to do 8-dot Braille? And do you anticipate getting the power consumption down to the level where you can reasonably run it off batteries?
At the moment, we're focusing on the 1 standard of Braille. I can't recall the obviously the different grades of Braille, but at the moment there's not much interest in our, well, it's not we're not interested, is at the moment we're focusing on 6-dot Braille. Sorry, what was your second question? The power consumption, yes. I mean, at the moment, the power consumption is quite high. It's in the order of 120 watts. That's because we've got many stepper motors in it. One of the things I didn't mention earlier is it's fantastically expensive to have motors made to a specification. So we've had to use motors that are readily available because we need them to be cheap to fit our design budget as well as the overall budget of it being a cheap machine to produce eventually, that only leaves us mass-produced motors. So the main actuator motor in there is from, I believe, a CD draw. And we've also used the motor that scans a floppy drive head. But the target is battery-powered and a day's use is what we're aiming for. Because, of course, it consumes no power once it's got a display on it. It switches off internally. Yeah.
Okay. I think we're probably going to have to wrap that up, I'm afraid. But if anyone does have any more questions, then I'm sure Russell will be available to answer them
afterwards. Yeah, I'm going to hang around the tent afterwards if you want to chat. So, yeah.
Cool. Okay. Thank you very much again, Russell.